Welcome to Alchemical Dialogues, an Amber Light podcast. Join Dr. Henry Critella and Shahabuddin David Less for their discussion on the shift in human consciousness. The information provided on this website and these podcasts is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this website and in these podcasts is intended to be a substitute for medical, health, therapeutic, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed by the guests in these podcasts are not necessarily the opinions of Amber Light International and anyone associated with this organization.
So welcome, everyone, and welcome, Shahabuddin, my dear friend.
Thank you.
I'm so glad that we can do this. So for people who don't know you that are listening, Shahabuddin and I have known each other since the late 1990s. Depends how you define our start date together. That's another podcast. Shahabuddin David Less is an author and a meditation teacher, founder of Rising Tide International, a center for meditation and consciousness in Sarasota, Florida. And he's also chairperson of the Abrahamic Reunion, which he co-founded, an interfaith peacemaking nonprofit. It was founded in 2004, doing peace work in Israel and Palestine. And he and I have been connected since the late 1990s. He's my spiritual guide, a friend and a teacher, and I'm thrilled that we're able to do this together. The topic that we chose was the shift in human consciousness. But for people who don't know you, tell them a little bit more about how you came to be involved in this kind of work.
In my own meditation early this morning, interestingly, that very topic came about. And I was a young man and I had some spiritual experiences, some plant-induced, and others more and more without any external stimulus. And I eventually, through a series of circumstances, found my teacher, who was Pir Vilayat Khan. Shortly thereafter, I found the other half of my teaching duo, which was Murshid Sam Lewis. But there was a critical point in my life before I had met any of my teachers. I was working in the family business, which was a huge business. And for what I seemed at the time was ridiculous reasons, my mother didn't like my wife, Surya, at the time. My father called me in one day and basically fired me. And I was shocked. But he said, well, you work for 3 months and slowly taper off. And of course, I, having a lot of fire in my chart, said, no, I'm leaving today. And I did. First, I told him I could not believe he was caving, but he did. Anyway, why am I telling this story? Because this morning I was thinking about a darshan I had later in life, maybe two years later, from Pir Vilayat. A darshan being a direct transmission from the unseen, very clear, very direct, very real guidance. Pir Vilayat was sitting up on a rock and he was looking at me. And I didn't ask anything, you know, in a darshan, you just let them release what they see. And he looked at me and he said, you think your father fired you, don't you? And I said, yeah, I was there. I know my father fired me. And he said, it wasn't your father. And I was really surprised. And I said, well, who was it? And he said, it was the prophet Abraham. And I, being young and a little snotty at the time, said, wait a second. You mean the prophet Abraham came down from heaven. What am I going to do today? I'm going to fire this schmuck, you know? That's what was going on? And Pir Vilayat didn't blink, and he said, yes, Abraham fired you. And I said, why? He said, well, there are other things for you to do. From that point on, there were many other things for me to do. Many doors opened. If I had stayed where I was, who knows what would have happened, but in a way, in many ways, it would have been much more difficult, much more difficult. And there might be a few people who don't know the whole story, but I can say 35 years later, my parents and myself and my family had a very deep reconciliation, which lasted for 10 or 14 years until my parents died. So that story outwardly is quite interesting and dramatic, What it means inwardly is that we have potential destinies. We have potential destinies. I say potential because it's up to us. There's nothing that's written in stone. And we know it. And as my consciousness changed, I made changes in my life. I'm still making changes in my life. And I'm doing them to reflect my own heart vision, God ideal, if you will. And hopefully other people harmonize with that. I don't intend to create disharmony. I intend to create harmony. And over the years, I've learned to control myself too, so that I'm a more capable transmitter of what I'm experiencing in a way that can help other people and helps me, because I'm fulfilling my life's purpose.
So I think that leads into one of the areas that we wanted to talk about, which is a new way of partnering, a new way of being with other people.
Yes. No, I'm just trying. It's a big topic. I'm trying to feel where to begin. I had a very interesting conversation with someone the other day. And in that conversation, I reminded them that basically souls in relationship incarnate in two ways, like animals too, certain animals too. Some people pair for life. Some people have multiple partners, polygamous partners. And I'm not just talking marriage, by the way. When I say partners, I have a very broad definition. And some people never find a partner, a quote, soulmate, even though everybody's our soulmate. And we try and project whatever our definition is, our experience is, on other people. And it makes us quite judgmental, frankly, and quite narrow, and we miss a lot of experience in life. If someone is basically a loner, now I'm not saying an introvert, because believe it or not, I'm actually introverted, but a loner, in other words, they really are here to live their life alone. Others might judge them for that, and that's very wrong, in my opinion. They're living what's natural to them. If someone is here and they have a best friend and that's their relationship for life, it doesn't have to be gender opposites or any of the ridiculous things we project onto things. But if that best friend is their co-incarnator and that lasts for life or a long time, how wonderful is that? So we have to define partnership, not for society. I'll tell you a story that always comes to mind, and I tell it because it makes people laugh, but it's actually quite deep. This was about 20 years ago. I was in India, and there was a big article in the Times of India of an interview with the Dalai Lama. And in that interview, which was front page in Delhi, the interviewer asked him about homosexuality, male homosexuality, I think he said, but who knows what. And the Dalai Lama started to laugh, and he said, well, I can't answer as a Buddhist, and I can't answer as the head of the Tibetan Nyingma community or anything else. I can only answer as me, just a human being. And then he paused for a moment, and he said, I don't particularly care who puts what in what hole. That's not what matters to me. What I care about are people's heart, their compassion, their awakening. That's what matters. So it was very shocking for some and humorous for some, but it really hit me very deeply, not because of my opinions, which I don't know if I had any at the time or have any now, but because of the ability of this human being to get beyond judgment, not to express an opinion, you know, not to say this should be or that should be, this is right or that's right, but just to say, I don't care about that. And it was a great lesson, which has helped me incredibly in my relationship in Israel and Palestine, because many things come up and I have to pull back and say to myself, Shabbatin, you don't care about that. That's not your issue. And I think if we, in looking at others in our relationship with others, if we can expend the effort to really learn from each human being, there is so much that will transform us. And we will be better partners. We become bad partners when we become too self-centered. We're not listening anymore.
Right. What I wanted to get to was we're not just talking about intimate relationships or marriages or partnering in that way, just being with each other, being in groups together, having that attitude of what's really important and not being judgmental. That's really hard to come by. We're not traditionally trained that way or conditioned that way.
Yes. You know, to be clear, I get judgmental too. It's not that I'm beyond it. But what I've learned to do is recognize when I'm judgmental by not judging myself. I always think of the great spiritual teacher, Papa Ramdas, in Anandashram in India. He's died in the 60s. He would never speak of himself in the first person. Whenever he spoke, he always said, Ramdas did this and Ramdas did that. And when he wrote many books, and he always says, well, Ramdas, what are you doing? And it just struck me how brilliant that is, how much we associate the power of the soul with the I, rather than associating the power of the soul with this limited being, which is what we are at some level.
Right.
Of course, at some other level, we're not that. But to get to the other level, you got to deal with the gateway, which is our limited self.
So the other part that I've been thinking about is part of our training and conditioning. So my training professionally was as a physician, a psychiatrist. And I'm actually very thankful that of all the specialties that I could have chosen, I chose psychiatry, because I somewhat teasingly say psychiatrists are trained to really be able to act without really knowing what they're doing. I can say that because I'm teasing, but there's some truth to that in the sense that you're in something with somebody, a family or a person, and you're struggling together. And the physician training is we're supposed to know what to do. Reality is I have a set of skills. The person I'm working with has a set of skills. And together we start to decide which skills are going to be used. But there's a partnership involved. It isn't as controlling. I don't know if that's quite the right word. Controlling as I used to think it was when I was younger and training as a physician. And I think that was a gift that my field gave to me, is that I had to really listen. And I couldn't shy away from what I was trained in. I had a body of knowledge that the people I'm working with didn't have, but I shared it. And sometimes I would come on strongly. Many times it wasn't. There was a menu of things we could do. And what we did, we partnered. We decided this is how we're going to approach it. At least that's in the best of times that I could remember. And I think that's part of what we're talking about.
It is what we're talking about. And I think the relationship with the quote spiritual teacher, which traditionally was, and in many cases is, hierarchical. The teacher's here, the student is here. And that to me is a relationship that doesn't work anymore. What's happening now is we are partners. And in a partnership, when one has a certain talent, they step forward and attain the hierarchical position, so to speak. But in areas where they're not talented, they step backward and let another person who has the skill, who has the talent. I mean, I'm amazed when people ask me things because they think I know everything. And the reality is I don't. I don't make any claims to know everything. I know that the relationship that I appreciate with someone who appreciates a relationship with me, a spiritual relationship, is that of co-equals. And I have no problem ever saying, I don't know. It actually gives me a little bit of a high. It really does, because it makes me realize that I'm realizing, I'm self-aware,
right,
instead of just giving automatic answers, which unfortunately we're sometimes expected to do. And that's ridiculous. I mean, there's no reason why anybody should have to answer every question. It's absurd. We wouldn't expect that. So in that way, and this is really the essence for me, the relationship with what has traditionally been called the spiritual hierarchy, which is these beings, illuminated beings in the unseen world, maybe they've incarnated, maybe they haven't, these beings are available to co-partner with us because we are on the earth. we have this physical body that is able to experience sensually in our senses that which they can't, or they won't if they can. So, of course, Abraham could step in and fire me, but I could have stepped back and say, no, I don't accept that. Now, I'm glad that I didn't do that, but it is a partnership. And spiritual guidance is of two kinds, maybe many more, but two that I know of. One is absolute and one is relative. The absolute guidance, which is very rare and which we do have to practice to be able to experience, the absolute guidance is unquestionable. You get it? And you know, oh my gosh, this is it. The relative guidance is more of a gentle invitation. Murshid Sam said something so brilliant. He said, what the guide does is they see you at the beginning of a path. Let's think of a physical path. And they say to you, you know, if you walk down that path, there are holes in the path that you can fall in. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't walk down the path. And that really is real relative guidance. You're free. You don't have to walk down the path. But if you want to, just be aware of what the path is. And maybe they'll say, really be careful when you enter the jungle or when you enter this psychological state, is really what they're saying. All of that is partnership. And ultimately, and I'd be remiss, of course, if I didn't say it, ultimately, there's one being, the eternal, the only being. None exists but that one being. So who are we in partnership with? Well, I'm not going to answer that, but you get the idea.
Right. This is part of the shift in human consciousness that we're talking about. And I agree with you. And in my work with you, that's something that we touched on really early. For some reason, some people on the call know the story, but it was early in our relationship. I had already initiated and started working with you. And you said something that really made me angry. It was at a dance camp in Niagara Falls. And so you went off to lead a dance and I stayed in my room pouting. And you noticed that I wasn't there and you caught Kathleen and said, where's Henry? And she said, he's in his room. I don't know if you remember this. And you came up, you sat on the bed and I'm looking at you and you said, basically, what's up? And I don't think I told you, but actually I think you knew. And you said with a sigh, what do you think our relationship is? And without thinking, out of my mouth came something like, well, right now I'm getting guidance from you, but eventually we're going to be colleagues. And you shook your head and you said, yes, that's it. And when you left, what I remember about this is I had no idea that's what we were going to be talking about. I had no idea I was even thinking that. And I really believe that. And over time, it's helped me in my guidance with people when I guide people, is that the relationship changes. You know, when it doesn't change, either it doesn't change because it's not supposed to change. That's the way it needs to be. But also it could be a warning that there's something else that could be done, because everything changes and everything has potential in it. And you giving me that reminder, the invitation, and actually the guidance, let the relationship change, that has always been in my mind. And I thank you. I don't know if I thank you for that, but I'm thanking you for that now. But I think that's what we're talking about. You know, knowing it early on, knowing that, being aware of that, not holding on to something and wanting something to be that way forever because it feels so good, or you think it's right, or you're too afraid to let it change. That, I think, is still a danger in a lot of the circles in which we live.
I'm with you.
So we talked about that happening in the spiritual guidance realms. So with teachers, with organizations, I assume, but it isn't just the spiritual realm. I think in our everyday lives, the professions we're in, the relationships that we're in, this is something that's cutting across all of those situations or boundaries. It's the real shift in consciousness that's not just in one area alone.
We should mention something about individual karma and the way we incarnate. Some people incarnate a whole boatload of karma. They stop continually. This is allegorical or not literal, but they stop continually and continually merge with souls leaving the earth at every plane of consciousness. And there are so many planes of consciousness, degrees. And they take on and they take on whatever's not finished. And they come in, or we come in, whoever it is, and have all of this preconditioned impressions implanted in our, actually, it's really in our cells. It's really in our blood. And for them, or for us, it might be me, to immediately try and develop a collegial relationship, regardless of how much knowledge they have, is not always successful. In your case, it was, but it's not always successful because the conditioning is still there and it affects us in a relationship. And again, not just a spiritual relationship, any relationship. I know people who are very successful materially. I know people who are very successful emotionally and successful physically and so on. Yet some of them are so affected still by this massive burden of karmic weight that they have to divest themselves of. I know other people who incarnated without much karma. Now, what's interesting to me is I look at teenagers and younger, and I see that they are incarnating with less karma, not more karma, less karma than the previous generations. That is a big evolutionary leap. And the reaction that we're seeing in so much of the world, a reactionary reaction, is not just mental, not just egocentric. It is a reaction to the incarnation of human beings without a ton of karma because we're not used to it. And we think there must be something wrong. So from the millennials on, we are seeing really a different kind of incarnation. And, maybe the indigo people or whatever you want to say. And it's natural that there would be a reaction to it, to those who don't speak that language. They're feeling left out and insecure. But we need to remember that, nevertheless, these souls are incarnating. And they are partnering in very different ways. And they are comfortable working with groups of people. They don't have to be the one that stands out. They just have to be part of the group. And the question for some of us gray-haired people is, are we willing to accept that? We can find it threatening too. But the spiritual teachers either came in with less karma or they learned to remove a lot of the karma they came in with. That's why spiritual teachers engender so much resistance. I think most of you on this call know who Inayat Khan was. I have no doubt personally, you can say it's my opinion or whatever you wish. I have no doubt that Inayat Khan was the prophet, if not the prophet of this age. I have no doubt of that. I don't ask you to believe it. I don't care about that. But I know that that's my experience. And because of that knowledge, I partner with people differently, with all of you. And with me and with others very differently, because I feel like I am representing an archetype. And I feel like all of us are or could be. And that's a role of the future. He was not, in a funny way, a prophet for the present. He was a prophet for the future. So there is a relationship between less karma, who incarnates, and what develops in the future. And we're at a very wonderful point right now.
So what help is there for the more gray-haired people that are uncomfortable?
Well, I would say take psychedelics, you know, have some experience where you feel what it's like to be one and get out of our continually tripping mind. If you don't want to take psychedelics, which maybe you don't, I don't. I haven't taken psychedelics for eons, but I still try to get the experience of unity. And what help is there? Make a list of what's important to you. If that is number one, you'll get it. If it's not number one, you won't. Except that that's not really true. There's grace and all kinds of things happen, but it sounds good.
So the
Wait, I didn't finish yet. Okay. You asked a legitimate question. Assuming you don't want to take psychedelics and you don't want to make the list, what help really is there? I can tell you, it's not very dramatic. It's not very sexy. But the other thing you can do is force yourself to be kind. There are many people, even some of us on the call, who are not naturally kind. Again, because of our karma and our conditioning since we've been born. But make kindness as a more important habit than eating, and something will happen.
Right.
And of course, you need to be kind to yourself.
Right.
And that comes first, not last, by the way. Right. You train on yourself. How do I be kind to myself? And then you can be kind to other people. Otherwise, it's kind of hypocrisy.
I think part of the conditioning has been, see how I can put this. It's almost like there's an inborn knowledge that there's one truth, but that gets translated into what we think of as everyday knowledge. For me, it gives rise to, it's too hard to keep an open mind. I have to hold on to the one thing that I think is true. And then you wind up being narrow-minded instead of open-minded.
Yeah.
And that's partly education. I think we were going to talk about education too. So for young children, you know, the education, at least I think it's changing, but there's one way of learning. The idea that there are so many different ways to learn, it's really hard to program for that. Because the idea is people are on a schedule, children are on a schedule, they need to learn a certain way so we can evaluate that to see if they're really learning. I lucked out as a child, and I think I knew this when I was a child, that the way I was being taught fit with the way that I tended to think. It played to my strength. But I had friends that were so much more capable than I was, but in a different area. They were more hands-on. I couldn't do anything when it came to visual, spatial, using my hands. But with an idea, I was great at ideas. That's the way that I was being taught. My friends were being forced to learn that way, and they couldn't do it. And at least back then, they didn't have any other alternative. The teachers didn't know what to do, or they were being forced to teach in a certain way, even though they knew it wasn't reaching certain children. So all the judgments that come with that, the conditioning that comes with that, I think it leads to the opposite of what you're talking about. It leads to more narrow-mindedness. And then when you do find something, it's hard to let go. It's almost as, well, this is the one and only truth. So everybody should believe what I'm believing, because the world will be such a better place if everybody just believed this one truth.
First of all, I don't believe there is any one truth. I don't think anything I can say or you can say is true. I really, really know that when something is put into words, it loses its truth immediately. It might be close to the truth and it might help us experience the truth, but it's not the truth. And if we want to talk about education, for those people who do well in our standard educational model, what they're lacking is the corresponding education in other areas. And I think that's really a mistake. When my kids were young, we lived in Bali for a year and a half, and the kids were tutored by a 16-year-old young woman, and they spent about an hour a day on their subjects. They came back to America, and their school said, well, we have to jump both of them a grade ahead at least. One of my sons was learning disabled, and yet they jumped him a grade ahead because he was learning in a way that he could learn. And the reason we standardize education is because of money. And what does that tell me? It tells me that the tribe has gotten too big and the economy is ruling things that shouldn't be ruled by the economy. The tribe has gotten too big Because once you get past that level, which maybe I'm going to guess 80 people, then all of a sudden the education becomes something else. It's not a transmission from generation to generation. It's not saying, hey, these were the mistakes we made. It's instead more of how can we maintain the status quo? And that doesn't give room for exploration. I don't think it's any mistake that the founders, the entrepreneurs of almost every large successful corporation that is moving our technology forward were all college dropouts.
Right.
You know, and we say it as if it's normal, but why? Why? Facebook, Microsoft, Amazon, just down the list, why? Well, there's a whole group, the PayPal Mafia. They started that whole auto pay system and so on. Dropouts. And they all dropped out of great schools, Harvard, Stanford, and so on. Why? Because the spirit needs to be free to learn the way it needs to learn. And when the spirit realizes it, it tries to flee. And then the weight of the huge tribe that we have now pushes it back in. And it takes a lot of courage and chutzpah to get past that pressure.
I don't think it's just the economy, Shavani.
Well, I don't mean literally the economy. I mean the whole global economic system and cultural system.
Yeah, cultural system hits home with me, right? Somehow, there's a real need, it feels like, to be in control. It's almost as if you can make kids learn what you think they should learn, and somehow you feel safer as adults, rather than trusting that the kids have an innate, inherent desire to learn. I think a lot of what we do educationally shuts off that desire rather than turns it on. But left to their own devices, like early Montessori education, even though I wasn't exposed to that, I have friends and we did a podcast on that. But it's Maria Montessori was just amazing at what she was able to learn from kids. And that kids and adults, I don't think it stops with childhood, want to learn, they want to collaborate, they want to work. And we have a culture that actually turns that off. Because somehow we bought into the idea that somebody knows better. Somebody knows how we should be, how we should work, how we should live. And I think that's cultural.
Well, dude, if you can get that across wherever you can, I think that is a message that can possibly save this planet. I really mean that. The idea that what we call freedom is really not free. And we're teaching those who really are free to be not free.
Right.
Really needs to be understood. And yes, education, it's got a long way to go. It really has a long way to go. I don't know if education will change what the aspect of it you spoke of without a shock. And maybe we will have a shock. I don't know. I hope not. Yeah. I hope it can change in other ways.
And I think education, I mean it broadly. Yes, with kids, and maybe that's the most important because, you know, we're all still learning. And, you know, I've had a higher education. And, you know, I look back and in psychiatry and in my spiritual pursuits, I've developed curriculums. I bought into this. I thought not all curriculums are bad, but I kind of thought, this is the way that people should do things. And then in my psychiatry career and also in what I've been doing spiritually, I look back and I say, wow, I feel like I opened Pandora's box. I wanted to give a little nudge about, okay, here's some areas we need to look at that if you're training to be a psychiatrist or if you want to be a spiritual guide, here's some foundational things. And then all of a sudden, it just kind of took off that you're getting evaluated, you have to be able to show that you can do this and you can do that. And it's like you get out of control.
Well, because people are resistant to change. We say we like it, but we're really afraid of change.
Yeah.
And the whole idea of a student and a teacher, that has to change too. I mean, coming back to us on this call here.
Right.
That whole relationship has to change. And yet it gave many of us such great security.
Yes.
But how would it change? Well, I remember distinctly, without going into detail, there was a point where my relationship with Pir Vilayat changed. And we became really quite good friends, and we shared things with each other. And it was real. And it doesn't mean he wasn't my teacher. You know, he was, but I also recognized that I had to step up and take my role with him too, which meant saying things that didn't always make him happy, frankly. Right. That's what we're looking for. We're really looking for what Inayat Khan called his first book, even though it's volume 5, which was Spiritual Liberty. We're looking for freedom. The soul wants to be free. We bind it by these forms that we put in front of it until the soul gets so drunk by these forms it believes it is that. And we need to sober up. We really need to sober up. And it's funny, but sobriety leads to ecstasy, and our drunkenness just leads to pain.
So good point. So this is what we're talking about when we're talking about a shift in human consciousness. And it's not a little shift. I think we're talking about a really revolutionary shift.
I hope so. Otherwise, we won't survive on this planet.
Right.
You know, and I don't mean that in gloom or doom, but if we don't allow the natural changes to occur, then this particular chapter of humanity will end. It's happened before, a number of times, and it could happen again. On the other hand, we've never, ever, ever, I know some of you probably sick and tired of hearing this, but it's so important. We have never on this planet had a global civilization. Never. We've never had the technology that could unite us all like this. You know, we've never had it. And what will it do? Well, for one thing, it's going to bring us to outer space. And how many people do you think of the 7.5 billion people on the planet Earth, how many have been to outer space? Anybody want to take a guess? 500, less than 500 since 1960, whenever the Russians sent that first rocket up, less than 500 people. That means on this planet of 7.5 billion people, 500 people only have experienced the ability to be in outer space and look back at planet Earth, unless you're really good in meditation, in which case you can have a very similar experience. But physically, only 500 people, less than 500. So we need that. We need to be out there looking back at the blue planet to really understand what our role is. And that will give us the inspiration to give up some of our selfish needs for the future of this jewel. And, you know, we want help. We want help to become a global, understanding, sympathetic, compassionate civilization, but we won't take help. Help is available in the unseen world, in our hearts and minds. You spoke about learning by the mind. It's fine, but ultimately everything has to come through feeling. And feeling is the heart. And I don't just mean surface emotions. I mean deep feeling. If we don't feel, we don't learn. And we only learn when we feel. And when we feel, we can learn things in a day that would take us a year, if ever, to learn. Do we teach that in school? No. And what do kids do? They cry. They laugh. They play. They're feeling. They're in the natural state. We're not.
Correct.
I agree. You know, and we get them in the classroom and say, be quiet. Learn this, sit still, all the things that are not natural for a kid. If you did it gradually, that's why I agree with you about Maria Montessori. She was really prophetic. She learned from children. So did Steiner. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's time to grow up or give it up.
So there's a comment or question in the chat. Why is this a shift? Has this not always been? Is this not a continuing problem of humankind?
If you wish, if you wish. I just think that as we have become so overpopulated, the density of mind thought has become heavier than it ever has. And the most difficult part is the disconnect with nature. I'm looking out my window. I can see 60 miles and I can see over 100 varieties of trees out my window. It does something to me. If I'm looking out my window, and I have done this in my life, I'm looking across an alley at a brick wall, that does something too. The absence of the connection with nature is really, really affecting us. So in the past, where there's so many fewer people and people lived in a closer connection with nature, yeah, they learned more. They learned more. So, you know, that's very sad, but that's, and again, there's one holy manuscript, one sacred book, only one, and it doesn't belong to any religion, and that's the sacred manuscript of nature.
You know, there are little things too. You know, I'm actually here looking out in my backyard, which is trees and grass and flowers and hummingbird feeders. And, you know, I purposely put this here so I can see that. But when I was an intern and a resident, I was the hospital that I trained in. I remember going in to see a patient and he looked at me and he looked out the window and we're overlooking a cemetery and it's a historic one. So there's a lot of famous people and you can take walks there and tours. But still, he looked and then he looked back at me and he said, "Nice impression, isn't it?" And I've always remembered that. And the particular hospital that I trained in is very different now. They had a big donation when it was first built, way before my time. The stipulation on the donation is absolutely no frills. It had to be bare walls, exposed pipes. It was scarier than hell. I mean, I remember they built a new hospital that overlooked the cemetery that was a little more up to date. But to get there, you went through the old part of the hospital. And I remember how we used to try to run through it because it was so uncomfortable, you know? And then later in my career, I started to do some mind-body work. And I visited another place that was known. They had a section that was devoted to more alternative medicine and mind-body medicine. As soon as I walked in, I heard a fountain. And it changed how I felt immediately. Even though I couldn't see any nature, I came in from a parking lot. I was in a lobby, but I heard the fountain. And then I saw the fountain. And I really noted how something changed in me, you know? And then I remembered that. And then someplace else, a major hospital system where I live, decided they were going to try to promote mind-body medicine. But what they did is they took a small number of practitioners who were going to do this in a satellite hospital, and they put them in the basement. So before you could get there, you had to go down underground into the basement. And people would comment on, "It's in the basement." And it's like, you know, you don't have to be in the wilderness. You can do little things that seem like common sense at this point, but we've forgotten that you can have nature inside by how you use sound, and how you use decorations, and paying attention to what you're looking at when you do look out a window, that all of that has an effect on a person.
That's very beautiful, Wadud. And I feel badly for you about experiencing health so young, but I guess that's part of life. We live in the physical world. We also live in a world of four directions. Native Americans would say seven, but I'm going to today say four. The four directions are earth, water, fire, air. We live in those elements. That affects our mind, it affects our breath, and we are partnered with those elements continually, unless we say, "No, I don't want to do that." And how do we say that? Well, we could say that by numbing our senses. That's what alcohol, for example, does. Or we can say it by going into psychological states that don't allow us to be open to these four directions. And going into nature, actually going into nature, not just a fountain in the room, even though I understand and agree with you, all of that helps, beauty helps, but actually going into nature, whether it's going into the water or going for a hike, or I mean, I don't have to describe the different hundreds of things, but going into nature brings a certain balance to us. And it certainly does that with kids. I was here a couple of weeks ago with my six grandchildren, just me, for a week. Here you can see my t-shirt. It says Camp Baba, June 2021, age 7 to 11. And people said to me, oh, you're crazy. All six of them, how are you going to handle it? On and on and on, which was their own fear. I did not have any difficulty, quite frankly. But what did we do? Every day we went for a walk. I didn't call it a hike, even though it might have been 3 hours. We were alone on a trail. There were no people, because I know some pretty isolated trails. And we went for swimming and swimming holes in streams, not in a swimming pool with a lifeguard and everything. But hey, look at this beautiful little place. Let's take a dip. We just did what was natural in nature. And even though we walked every day without exception, we also took a walk around a lake. There's a lake right here in the town I live. And why? Because it had tons of baby ducks and geese and birds and swarms of catfish just hatched and so on. And I watched them reclaim that part of themselves. Now, fortunately, and this is the point, not to exaggerate, but fortunately, all of their parents make a point to do the same thing with their kids all the time. And so they are comfortable within these four directions. Whereas both kids and adults who are not aware of the value of this become easily out of balance. So we need it in the same way we need food and good air. We need that connection with Pan, the real energy of nature, the balance of those four directions. And I can't emphasize that enough.
There were two comments in the chat that fit with sure. One was a ritual that someone described that their 8-year-old boy, when they walk out to walk to school with the person, insists on smelling the rose bush. And that's really
yeah.
And someone else commented that it might be very nice that if kids were allowed to spend half of their time in school looking inward, experiencing inner movements and learning to work and live with them. So like 40% inward, 30% outward in nature, 30% typical learning, trying to learn a body of knowledge, but something much more balanced with a real foundation in the natural world.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea, but some kids may want 90% in nature and they should have that. Some kids might want 90% learning. They should have that. So we have to have the intelligence to really understand the kids. I don't want to malign our teachers. I mean our school teachers. They got a tough job. They don't get paid enough, and it's a lot of work. And let's say it's not uncommon if you have a job where you're underpaid for what you do to find ways to do it easier, not to necessarily take that extra step. And yet there are so many school teachers who really do it. And they don't have to. They really don't have to. They could get by. So I don't want to malign the teachers. I feel like it is the responsibility of me as grandparent or you as parent or whatever it is to get involved, not just have ideas and opinions, but get involved.
Early on in my career, I was doing consulting work at a special education center. And I had this bright idea that teachers needed support. So I ran an early morning group. I guess you would call it a mini version of a sedate safe encounter group, or T groups, if you're old enough to remember what those were like. And I remember how dedicated they were, how they had to buy supplies from their own pockets, and how angry they were because they had the expectation that it should be provided by the administration. and that the administration are supposed to be taking care of these problems. And I was kind of flying by the seat of my pants. And what happened is they developed a sense of, well, all of that's true, but at the same time, we have some agency, we have some power. And this was all private. We weren't going to check in with the administration, except is it getting in? I can't remember what the rules were exactly, but it wasn't like conversations were going to be divulged to the principal or something. But maybe halfway through the year, I did check with the principal, you know, we're going to continue doing this. Is there anything you want to share with me? And the principal said, yeah, people are coming to me more and they're being, in a good way, more assertive, and they're also taking care of things instead of just expecting me to take care of problems. And there was a noticeable change in the group over the course of the year. And then the group moved, and it was so powerful that they wanted to continue the group when they moved to a different school. It didn't work. I was running out of steam, but also, you know, the system was changing and it was getting even harder to work in it. But I still remember that feeling of respecting what they had to do and a system that was not as forgiving as it should be and not as giving as it should be. And still within that, when they felt heard and empowered, they figured out a way of doing it with less anger and with more agency. And what a change it made in their atmosphere and their feeling as a group of teachers who were working together. So I think respecting each other and to the best you can do, given a system that you have to live in for now, feeling the power that you do have, the agency you have, and that somebody is listening to you and respecting that.
If anybody has questions, don't hold them back now and think, oh, I should have asked that. If you have a question, either raise your hand or put it in the chat.
So there's one more. So this is going back to your comment on psychedelics. And I just want to remind people that we're not advocating anything through Amberlight. We're not telling you what to do. And we're not saying you should or should not take psychedelics. So please remember that. But the question was, somebody knew someone who might be interested in psychedelics, but they also have an addictive personality and have had trouble with alcohol and other drugs. So are there risks? Anything to mitigate the risks? So without giving a prescription, you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Of course, there are risks. But one thing that we have developed both in North America and in Europe, there are professionals now who can guide you through a psychedelic trip, especially, frankly, with people who are dying, other conditions, but especially that. But I would say, again, maybe Amber Light's not advocating it, but if it seems right, find someone who knows what they're doing and do it with that person. There are people who do this. And I think we're going to see it more and more. I think it's going to be a real profession in the future. If any of you are looking for a new career, but you're going to have to take a trip or two yourself so you know what you're talking about.
Well, there was some pretty good research early on.
Yeah.
And then there was an event that happened that scared everybody, and all of a sudden the funding dried up. But you can't ignore the early research, and it is starting to come back. There are drugs that are being used for depression, for example, that we never would have used in my day as a practicing psychiatrist. So you're right.
Yeah. So it's just like anything else. I mean, I wouldn't self-prescribe medication, Western allopathic medication. I would go to someone who's a professional.
Right.
And it's the same here.
Right. Aziza, you have your hand raised.
Thank you, Shahabuddin, for the definition of absolute versus relative guidance. Other than meditating and connecting consciously to source that guides us, do you have any suggestions for improving our ability to listen and receive that guidance so that it leans more toward absolute?
Again, remembering every one of us is quite different, but if I had to come up with a general suggestion, I would say make sure that you genuinely cry 3 times a day. Not try, cry, that you cry 3 times a day, that you're moved to tears 3 times a day. And I don't just mean, you know, watching, I don't know if they still have commercials on TV or what, but I mean really something that moves you. Maybe it's that you love somebody else. Maybe it's you love something in you, but that it brings you to the state of tears. I could cry right now looking at all of you. And if you do that, the heart will open. Now, we could end this cast right now, and there would be people who will resist what I'm saying and prove that it's wrong. Maybe it is wrong for them. I can only speak from my own experience. And I know that if I'm moved to tears, something in me is awakening. So maybe not the answer you expected, but that's my answer.
Thank you.
I used to cry the drop of the hat watching something on TV, doing ceremonies. And I remember you once said, well, you know, you have to learn to cry on the inside.
Yeah.
Just so you know, I'm worse instead of better. I cry even faster now.
Well, maybe, good for you.
Maybe that's right.
Means you're evolving.
Right.
I was actually speaking about a situation about crying on the inside. Sometimes if you're presenting in public, certain points, you need to keep the tears within you because it'll diminish the magnetism of what you're saying. But, you know, as many of you know, I don't mind crying publicly.
But it is hard to get the words out while I'm swallowing my tears.
Right, right. That's what I'm saying. It affects the magnetism. It does.
It does, and I haven't quite succeeded in that part yet.
Yeah.
So we need to start winding down. Any last words that you can think of to summarize the ideas, feelings you have about the shift in human consciousness that we've been dancing around?
Well, instead of last words, can we do 1 minute guided meditation?
Sure.
1 minute. I'm going to set my timer. Everybody get ready. Now, you only have a minute, so you got to get there on the first breath. Don't worry about it. Are we ready? Inwardly say your name, not out loud, but inwardly say, I am, and fill in your name. Now, in the heart mind, say, I am a child of God. Now, in the heart mind, say, I am the caretaker of everything I see, feel, and know. Now say, I am the provider, and I am the receiver. And finally, in the heart mind, say, my soul is becoming unburdened, and I am awakening. Now take a breath and open your eyes. A few words. We have to be the change that we seek. Now that's not new. I'm sure all of you have heard that. But that's our first work. We have to be that change as best we can, as often as we can. And the other thing is, there was this guy a few thousand years ago, and he said, judge not that you be not judged. Judging is a habit. It's just a habit. We can break that habit and grow and be happy. So thank you, Wadud. Thank you, Habiba. Thank you, all of you. I've really enjoyed this, and now I have to go to work. Could I make an announcement? Well, I'm gonna. I'm doing a seminar in person at Rising Tide in Florida, and the most important thing is Tara asked me, well, what's the topic? And I said, I have no idea. I'm going to do whatever the topic is for that day. So if you want to come and enjoy a day of no idea, come on and join in. It'll be fun. So thank you again.
And thank you again. It's a pleasure for me. And I wish you good fortune in everything that you do. And we're continuing to support you.
Thank you for my colleague, and I feel like we're all colleagues.
We
you
are.
Know, it's yes, important.
That's the point. Love you all. Thank you for joining in.
If you find yourself enjoying our podcast, please do us a favor and spread the word. Tell a friend about it. Give us a review on iTunes or post it on social media. If you or someone you know would like to participate in a future podcast, please connect with us through the Contact Us page. See our events calendar page for dates to our next live podcast recordings. We'd love for you to participate and ask questions. And be sure to check out Joel Lessie's podcast, Unraveling Religion, on your favorite podcast app. Alchemical Dialogues are live and unscripted conversations recorded on Zoom, brought to you by the great folks of Amber Light International, a nonprofit organization co-founded by Henry Curtella, MD, and Kathleen Fitzpatrick, LCSW. We choose topics from our current social and cultural climate with an emphasis on humanism and spirituality.